dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. A particularly important place in that battle space is, of course, occupied by the United States Congress. We are delighted to have one of its leaders with us for our first segment. He is the Honorable Robert Goodlatte. He is the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. He has been representing the 6th District of Virginia with distinction since 1992. Mr. Chairman, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you with us.
Well, Frank, it's great to be with you and your listeners.
Let me start with Libya. You have raised an alarm, I think quite properly, with your colleague Jordan Chavis about an idea the Department of Homeland Security is apparently brooding about to allow Libyans to come here for things like aircraft maintenance and training in nuclear science. What on earth is that about?
Yeah, you would think we had totally forgotten about both 9/11 and what's going on in Iran right now, and the fact that Libya had a nuclear program at one time as well. So this is not a good idea, given the fact that Libya is a state where terrorism is very much alive and well, both evidenced by what happened in Benghazi a year ago and by what happened in the apprehension of terrorist Libby here recently. And the fact that this administration is simply unwilling to come to terms with that. Their effort always seems to be geared towards normalization, but I view their efforts at normalization as basically wanting to whistle past the graveyard, if you will, with regard to what happened in Benghazi and the long-term dramatically bad effect that has on our foreign service officers and others who serve in a lot of dangerous places around the world. If they're not going to be protected in Libya, why would they believe they're going to be protected in other hot spots?
As you say, 60 Minutes had a very interesting piece on Benghazi this weekend, and they talked about, you know, Al-Qaeda's flags flying on government buildings in places like Benghazi and the evidence that this whole idea of normalization was used to keep the security procedures from being enhanced in compounds that were designed to house and allow the operation of American diplomatic personnel and others. To the extent, Congressman Goodlatte, that we're looking at this sort of triumph of hope over experience, I guess you might say, does this argue now for a much more vigorous investigation of this whole policy approach of the administration in connection with Benghazi, among other things?
Well, it certainly argues for us not in any way backing away from the strong effort that the House has made to get to the bottom of Benghazi, and we should continue to do that. As you know, we have 5 committees, not led by the Judiciary Committee, but the Judiciary Committee is certainly participating in our effort to get to the bottom of Benghazi, both in terms of holding people accountable and in terms of figuring out what went wrong so that we can make sure that when requests for increased security come about in the future from other places around the world, that they get that increased security and not the goal to make things look better than they really are, which you use the phrase hope versus experience. And quite frankly, that's exactly what I think they were doing. They had promoted a policy in Libya that led them to where they were prior to Benghazi. And rather than deal with reality, they decided to deal with hope and deny requests for increased security because they wanted to make it look like increased security wasn't needed. That's just unbelievably outrageous.
Yeah. And the problem continues, of course, to this day. I hope you'll get to the bottom of this, Congressman Goodlatte. I've sort of been persuaded that we need a select committee to do that because it seems as though we're still spinning our wheels. But let me ask you about another question on Libya. You mentioned this terrorist by the name of Al-Libi. You've expressed concern that, as has been done elsewhere by this administration, we've sort of foreclosed the opportunity, perhaps, for a proper debrief, interrogation, if you will, of this terrorist because he was brought to the United States for trial in our judicial court system and read rights that I'm not quite sure why he's entitled to them. But talk a little bit about the dangers of foreclosing the debrief of such an individual at a time like this.
You are absolutely right that foreign nationals engaged in terrorist activities against the United States should not be accorded all the rights and privileges of United States citizens. In my opinion, he should be taken to a place like Guantanamo and held for questioning. That facility has certainly not been without controversy, but it also has certainly led to a lot of useful information that has protected the United States from another 9/11 type attack in the dozen years since that occurred, and we should not overlook
that. Thank God
that
you
fact.
All have been keeping it open. I want to commend you for that.
Right, but some of the new folks, and Al Libby is not the only one, have been brought not to Guantanamo, but to New York City, of all places, to be put on trial. And you correctly note that once that is done, they are entitled to the appointment of an attorney. And once that is done, they immediately clam up, and all of the information that we need to get about current Al-Qaeda operations is lost.
I couldn't agree with you more, Congressman, and I pray that this will be the end of it. But there's no end of insight, I'm afraid. Let me ask you about one other issue that you're deeply involved in. It's a complex issue. We won't have time to do it full justice. But you have properly expressed in your capacity, Bob Goodlatte, as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, concern about the Senate so-called Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill. You've got a list of 10 real flaws with it on your website, and you've offered a different approach, a sort of a piecemeal strategy for addressing some of the key issues. Congressman Michael McCaul on the Homeland Security Committee, your counterpart there, has offered a border security bill. I'm concerned about its shortcomings, to be honest with you, and wondering, how do we take any of these bills, if the House does enact them, and push them through a conference committee with the Senate without getting something that looks a lot like a defective bill that you're concerned about, as am I, over on the Senate side?
Well, that would be a very bad approach to take. The reason why we have advocated the step-by-step approach is because we've seen from experience, in fact, every American right now is living through the experience of passing a big, massive, comprehensive bill. Obviously, I'm alluding to Obamacare and the law of unintended consequences with those large thousands of page bills that result in thousands of more pages of regulations isn't anything like what the American people intend. It doesn't say that we don't have serious problems with our immigration policy, both enforcement, legal immigration reform, and finding the appropriate legal status for people who are not lawfully here. But it should be done. We don't call it piecemeal. We call it step by step. So we look at each issue carefully. We understand the interconnection between various aspects of these bills, and we also do not write them with the idea that they're etched in stone, but rather that they can be improved upon, both the four bills that have been passed out of the Judiciary Committee and the bill passed out of the Homeland Security Committee. And so that approach, I think, is the critical way to go about addressing this. We should not put legalization of people who are not lawfully here, as the Senate bill does, ahead of all of the different types of enforcement measures. And by the way, Frank, not just at the border. And this is a national security issue as well. Yes, securing the border is absolutely important. We've got to get that bill right. But it's also important to understand that 35-40% of the people who entered the country, who are illegally in the country, entered legally. Visas, student visas, visa waivers, and we need to make sure that we have interior enforcement. We need to involve state and local law enforcement, like we do with the enforcement of, you know, most other areas of the law. The state and local governments are given a role in that. In fact, I would argue that they have a constitutional role. But be that as it may, that's a part of the SAFE Act, one of the four bills that the Judiciary Committee has passed. And if we focus on all of these enforcement measures and truly are not walking down a path to repeat the mistakes made in 1986, then I think we could talk about other things.
Congressman, just very quickly, how do you get there from here without compromising on this massive bill that the Senate would presumably insist upon in any conference committee with one of your step-by-step bills?
First of all, we should not bring any bill to the floor of the House that does not have majority Republican support. And it's important to note that the Democrats did that in the Senate. They're in the majority there. And 70% of the Senate Republicans voted against that massive comprehensive bill. So we should be looking to have a clear majority of Republicans in the House supporting whatever we bring to the floor of the House. Secondly, we should not go to conference with the Senate on anything that will not result in something coming back to the House that will be able to get that same clear Republican majority vote. So the process here is to find the best bills, and we shouldn't presume how this will work out in the Senate, but we should presume how we're going to handle it in the House, reflecting a conservative approach and reflecting an approach that requires that majority of Republicans be on board, not just at the outset. And that's the policy we followed in the Judiciary Committee. That same model model needs to be used going to the floor. And then whatever we do, I mean, the Senate could reverse course. I have heard reports that Marco Rubio, who is very much involved in that Senate bill, now thinks they should take a different approach. And I think they should take a different approach, too. So if they were to revisit this and take a different approach, obviously we should look at what they do. But in the meantime, it's important for us to get the policy right. And it is better to have it right than anything else. And it is better to not produce any bill than to produce a bad bill. And Obamacare should be the lesson for that.
Boy, I couldn't agree more. Congressman Bob Goodlatte, thank you so much for joining us today, for your leadership. And we wish you the very best in making sure that we both have justice in Libya, and we also have a sound immigration policy as well. Thank you for taking your time. We'll look forward to
seeing
you again soon.
Look forward to be back with you again in the future.
Thank you, sir. Next up, another perspective on the implications of an open border, the Mexican cartels, and what they mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by George Grayson. He is a man of many parts. He is currently a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and an associate scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He was a professor for many years at the College of William and Mary and actually served for some 27 years in the Virginia State Legislature, a Democratic member of the Virginia State Legislature, no less. George, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Very nice to be with you.
You are shortly going to be publishing a new book that addresses topics of very considerable interest to me and I think our listeners. It's entitled The Cartels, The Story of Mexico's Most Dangerous Criminal Organizations and Their Impact on U.S. Security. And I'd like to start by sort of visiting with you about the cartels. What are they up to on really now both sides of the southern border of the United States?
They're still focusing their violence south of the border because they don't want to undertake especially dramatic killings and kidnappings in the United States, lest that raise their visibility on the radar screen at the White House. But they're extremely active on both sides of the border, and most of the violence now is taking place in a western state known as Michoacan. And there you've got the Knights Templars, and these Knights Templars who modeled themselves after an 11th century group of crusaders say they're doing the Lord's business by chopping people's heads off. And they're fighting against local self-defense groups and another cartel that comes out of Guadalajara. So it really is a killing field now in Michoacan, much to the dismay of the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto.
Yeah, I want to come to him in a moment. But just in terms of what's going on across the border, you say the violence isn't so great, though I understand there are instances in which the cartels are you know, sort of using muscle to get their drugs and human trafficking and other operations through the border. But what else is going on this side? I've been told that the cartels, some of them at least, have now established quite an expansive network in cities well north of the southern border. These are really very substantial criminal syndicates now. Is that right?
Yes, the Mexican cartels really provide most of the drugs that are sold in the United States. And they have wholesalers who in turn have retailers, but it's an extremely sophisticated business, and it affects every state, every Canadian province, and includes even a city like Memphis, Tennessee, which one doesn't think of as a hot spot of narco activities, but it is an important distribution network for the cartels.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, it is the hub of FedEx. I don't know whether there's any correlation there or not, but it certainly is the case that it's centrally located in the United States. And from there, I guess it's not too far to any other destination. To the extent that immigration, we were talking earlier in the program with the Congressman Bob Goodlatte from Virginia, a member you probably have come across over the years, about immigration. Legislation now working its way through the Congress. To what extent, George Grayson, is the fact that immigration laws are being so poorly enforced at the moment contributing to the freedom with which the cartels are now operating here, notably the porous border, of course, but internal enforcement of the law as well, as Congressman Goodlatte warned, is leaves a lot to be desired?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And you've got an area like Chicago, which has an enormously colony of migrants, legal and illegal, from Michoacan. And therefore, the Knights Templars have a community in which they can recruit retail sellers, they can recruit lookouts, and they can recruit consumers. And so I think the porous border certainly has contributed to the degree in which the cartels operate successfully in the United States. And that's one reason that even though I applaud the hard work of those who want to get into this country, I certainly oppose any new immigration laws. And Congressman Goodlatte and I might differ on that view.
Well, he's, I think, trying to hold the line on some of the worst of them, but there is concern that some of the better ones that he may be advancing will come a cropper as well. Go ahead.
Well, let me give you an example. We're greatly increasing the Border Patrol, but only a fraction of the new agents are undergoing background checks and polygraph tests.
Yeah, very troubling.
Because the FBI simply doesn't have the personnel to conduct them.
And George Grayson, one of the other concerns that we've been talking about on the program is the fact that the background investigation process itself has been seriously compromised over the years. So even that is troubling. But one other thing that I just wanted to run by you, especially given the attention you're paying to the activity of the cartels, George Grayson, is that the Border Patrol, I'm told, is being pulled back from the border, leaving sort of a no man's land in which areas of the United States are not being safeguarded against the kind of penetration that's been taking place. Are you seeing that, and is that compounding the problems that you're warning of?
The administration does not want to have really robust enforcement of our border laws. And so the Border Patrol is still active, but they're being encouraged to focus on the most dangerous criminals or possible criminals and sort of leave alone those who have merely been caught for speeding or drinking under the influence of drugs and alcohol. That is, Congress doesn't want to vote the money to back up its rhetoric about enforcing the border, and the administration doesn't want strong enforcement because Democrats want to see more Hispanic people in the United States because they will eventually vote the Democratic ticket.
Yeah, I'm concerned about that myself. Let me ask you finally, in closing, George Grayson, you mentioned the new president of Mexico, Peña Nieto. To what extent is he playing a constructive role in challenging these drug cartels, or is he perhaps now becoming part of the problem?
Well, Mexican politicians have always been part of the problem. Peña Nieto wanted to change the rhetoric and talk about fighting hunger, improving schools, upgrading health care. But the incredible violence that's taking place in Michoacan and to a lesser extent along the U.S.-Mexican border has forced him to deploy both the federal police and the military. And as a result, even though he talked about a change in policy from his predecessor, it's business as usual.
Continuing the fight. Well, I guess that's a good thing. George Grayson, we have to let you go. I appreciate very much your insights on this matter and in particular your warnings about insecure borders and the likelihood that this drug trafficking and other cartel activity might extend even further and more worrisomely into the United States. Keep up the good work at CSIS and elsewhere, and come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Andy McCarthy. We'll take stock with him on Obamacare and much more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's often observed that Albert Einstein described insanity as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. The United States is indulging in insane behavior at the moment, and the result is likely to be, as it has been in the past, more dead Israelis. Secretary of State John Kerry has insisted that Israel release convicted terrorists from its jails as a gesture to encourage so-called peace talks with one Palestinian faction. The release of 26 more expected to occur today will free not political prisoners, but brutal murderers of Jews. There has been more violence against Israelis since the government of Bibi Netanyahu reluctantly acceded to John Kerry's insane demands. There's no evidence doing so is actually advancing peace, and Israel should stop it. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, now a pundit par excellence, an author of best-selling books like Spring Fever, The Illusion of Islamic Democracy, and a personal favorite of mine, The Grand Jihad. He writes at National Review Online and at PJ Media. He is also frequently seen in other spots like Fox News, and we're always delighted to have him with us here. It's the high point of our week. Andy, welcome back.
Frank, great to be with you.
You've written most recently, I think, about a guy who is about to, by all accounts, take the helm of America's premier metropolitan city and take it, it would appear, hard left. Tell us a little bit about Bill de Blasio and what might befall New York if he were to become its mayor.
Bill de Blasio is basically an unrepentant socialist who was a great admirer of, for example, the Sandinistas back in the day. I would recommend to people a terrific op-ed that was written in the Wall Street Journal by Marta Cecilia Aviles Asman, who lived under the Sandinistas and has, I think, a better, more clear-eyed recognition of who they were and what it's like to live under the totalitarian left than de Blasio seems to have. But I think that what you're looking at with de Blasio is another sort of radical-turned, community organizer-type Alinsky work inside, bore in from the inside of the institutions type character.
An Obama knockoff, in other words.
Yeah, I think so, although I think he was, by at least the accounts I've seen, he was, I think, more openly radical than Obama was. Maybe Obama's just done a better job at keeping his paper trail away from everyone except Stanley Kurtz, but... I think this guy was much more open about it, is much less repentant about it. I think Obama's more in the nature of pretending it never happened. But in any event, he could be a real disaster, I think, for my city and the city that remains the number one terrorist target, certainly in the West, perhaps in the world. And one that has really staved off a repetition of 9/11 almost, I would say, very largely because of the pioneering police approach that was really pushed forward by Ray Kelly, which is an intelligence-first approach to counterterrorism that aims to prevent attacks from happening rather than content yourself with prosecuting whatever mass murderers happen to be left for you to prosecute after people have been killed.
Right. And de Blasio, as part of really the primary there in New York City, seemed to be competing aggressively to be the man who would do the most violence, not in a literal sense of the word, figurative sense of the word, to the Ray Kelly school of policing and perhaps as a result, in a very literal sense of the word, allow violence to be perpetrated on the city again. Is that – and Andy, you're speaking as a guy who formerly served in a top law enforcement position in the Southern District of New York for the federal prosecutor there. Are you worried that this is really going to come to pass if that kind of wrecking operation takes place?
Yeah, of course I'm worried. I mean, I was, as you say, I was a federal prosecutor in New York, hired by the other pioneer, Rudy Giuliani. And what we're talking about is basically the anti-Giuliani. Now, to be less panic-driven, mayoral primaries in New York are kind of like Democratic primaries for the presidency, in the sense that everybody kind of outdoes each other to get as far to the left as they think they can get away with or need to get away with, and then when it's time to appeal to the general electorate, you have to remember that New York includes, Queens and Staten Island and, the outer boroughs. It's not just the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So, people tend to try to move more to the center. De Blasio may end up doing that. But, based on his background, he is not someone who is likely to champion the kind of counterterrorism that we've had since 9/11. And he's also going to cut back on the stop and frisk issue that that New York City's been dealing with, and that was very aggressively defended by the city under Ray Kelly and Bloomberg, and I would be very surprised to see it aggressively defended afterwards.
Well, if not actively dismantled by the new mayor, and I guess really this is kind of the point. And as you said, New York City, the last time it indulged in the kind of hard left politics that is in prospect here with Bill de Blasio, was before 9/11. And we really haven't seen this kind of experimentation take place in an environment when it is unmistakably the case that it is in the crosshairs of jihadists who seek to do as much harm to us as they possibly can. And we're better than New York.
I think, Frank, that that's a big part of the problem. You know, it's we're old enough that it seems like only yesterday. But, you know, Rudy was elected mayor, I think, in around 1989 or so, if I'm remembering correctly. Maybe it was 1993. But in any event, in the living memory of many people who are voting in the elections in New York nowadays, they don't remember a time when New York was just an absolute basket case of crime. You know, forget about terrorism. It was you had rampant homicides and violent crime and gang violence and the like. We've been fortunate in the last quarter century to live through a real renaissance where New York became the safest big city in the world, to certainly in the United States, to live in. But, you know, it wasn't always that way. And as Reagan used to say, liberty was only a generation, right? And the same is even more true, I think, from the difference between the kind of New York we've seen in the last 25 years and the state of nature that existed before that.
Yeah, amen. Andy, let me ask you quickly about something that I spoke of with Congressman Goodlatte at the top of the show. He is, of course, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and I loud as how, you know, I'm not quite clear how it is that terrorists brought to this country, especially as enemy combatants, as they are in a war they wage against us, they call it jihad, are imbued with rights to lawyers and to, you know, maintain their silence and otherwise basically be treated as American citizens. And the congressman, to his credit, I thought, agreed that, you know, was absurd. What's going on here? Why is it that a guy like al-Libi, this Libyan terrorist, who's, by the way, not only implicated apparently in these attacks against two of our embassies in Africa some years ago, but more recently in the Benghazi attack, is lawyered up and evidently maintaining his silence at the moment?
Well, I think, Frank, the simple answer is that President Obama ran as a candidate in 2007-2008 as the guy who was going to turn back the clock to September 10th America. He wanted to go from the Bush law of war counterterrorism paradigm back to treating terrorism, even international terrorism, as essentially a crime, and regarding the people who commit it not as enemy combatants but as criminal defendants. Now, he, I think, overestimated how much the country was with him on that. I think he mistook the unpopularity of aspects of the Iraq war for unpopularity of Bush counterterrorism protocols in general, and I think he was wrong about that. They turned out to be much more popular than he thought. So doing a frontal assault on them, like trying to have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried in Manhattan, turned out to be a big failure. But he's learned from that. And I think what he's done is, without fanfare, he's quietly gone about the business of moving us back to September 10th in terms of our counterterrorism approach. And al-Libi is just the latest example of that.
It's a dangerous experiment, I'm afraid, as is the de Blasio candidacy. We'll be holding our breath on both, Andy McCarthy, and waiting for your commentary as the chickens come home to roost. Thank you very much for joining us. As always, Andy, it's good to talk with you. Next week, we'll do so again. In the meantime, we'll talk next with Mark Welch of Reason Magazine about a fascinating insight to what Lou Reed contributed to the anti-communists of Central Europe. More on that straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney.
Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Matt Welch. Today he is editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, the magazine, I think it's fair to say, of libertarian thought in the United States these days. He has had a very expansive background in journalism and previous incarnations, including as an assistant editorial page editor at the Los Angeles Times, and work at the Washington Post, LA Weekly, ESPN, and Columbia Journalism Review, among others. He also, which is very pertinent to our topic today, at least our first topic, lived for 8 years in Central Europe and worked to help found the first post-communist English-language newspaper there called Prognosis. Matt, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
You had a very interesting piece in your site, reason.com, the other day that caught our eye because you shed light on
a character who recently passed away, of course, and that got a lot of attention, but his contribution to anti-communism, notably in Central Europe, had eluded me. So talk a little bit about the rocker Lou Reed and the role he played in the part of the world that you've spent some time in.
Definitely an unintentional role and kind of a yeah. kind of a case study on how all kinds of culture, once they are created and thrown into the wind, can be grabbed onto and galvanize people for all kinds of purposes that the author of the culture didn't necessarily intend. Lou Reed, Velvet Underground, classic kind of very nihilistic, dirty rock music, sort of avant-garde. It came out in 1967 with their first record. They were under the auspices of Andy Warhol and his factory in New York, and all their songs were about heroin and sadomasochism and things like that. And that, you know, we can shrug that off in the 21st century a little bit, but at the time, even the most kind of hardened of rock critics were just shocked that there could be songs about this. The famous quote about it from Brian Eno, the great producer, is that, you know, 5,000 people bought the record, but they all started rock and roll bands.
That's impact.
which is impact. And including in the rock and roll bands were bands in Czechoslovakia back in 1968. 68, Prague underwent Prague Spring. It was a brief kind of thaw, a cultural opening, where under communism they were finally allowed to just have Prague have its normal role as a cultural capital of Central Europe, because it always has been. And so in that brief moment before the Soviet tanks crushed it in August of 68, a cassette of the Velvet Underground tape got in, and it immediately spoke to basically everybody who listened to it, including this guy named Milan Hlavsa, who's now deceased as well. He was a friend of mine. He got it and said, oh, my God, started a band called the Plastic People of the Universe, and they basically did a lot of Velvet Underground covers and Frank Zappa covers. And pretty soon, in the new normalization period of Soviet influence there, all rock music was basically outlawed. In 1976, the Plastic People, who only really existed by playing at weddings, is the only zone of freedom that they were allowed to experience. It was really an incredibly intolerant atmosphere. They were arrested for disturbing the peace because they helped organize a concert in Brno, the capital of Moravia. And that's what galvanized Václav Havel at the time. And he went and openly covered the trial. You didn't do that. You weren't allowed to do things like that. He just did. It basically kicked off the dissident movement. Charter 77, which we all know now, is this great human rights organization that helped topple communism. And it inspires people to this day in totalitarian countries like Cuba. It was started to defend the Plastic People of the Universe. So through this long chain of events, you know, one of the reasons why the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia was so called was because of the Velvet Underground. And when they finally overthrew communism there, Havel met with Lou Reed and just shocked him to his gills by saying, hey, did you know that I'm president because of you?
yeah. I imagine that kind of freaked Lou out.
but it also made him feel good. I mean, I interviewed Mo Tucker, who was the drummer of the band, when she came through Prague. All of the former members of the Velvet Underground would end up coming through Prague, where they're completely revered. There's a cover band there called the Velvet Revival Band that play constantly. And they were basically the theme band of the revolution. People would just be giddy and celebrating because they could dance and sing in ways that they couldn't before. So it's really it's a beautiful story. And it also reminds us, I think it should remind cultural conservatives sometimes, like the Dinesh D'Souza school of thought, that, you know, 9/11 was partly a response to our sick culture, and that we should reflect on that, you know, like maybe we should scale it back a little bit. You know, Lou Reed and Velvet Underground were considered just sort of dirty, filthy, you know,
about the sickest culture
defend.
Got.
and here, you know, and people think, well, you're rotting the morale at home and all this kind of stuff. Actually, people respond to cultural artifacts that express freedom.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating story. You tell it, obviously, with the extraordinary
passion of somebody who very much lived part of the repercussions of it at the very least. And so that adds texture to it in a wonderful way. And you must also be something of an aficionado of Lou Reed and the music scene so that you can appreciate how discordant this idea might be to those of us who, as you say, feel that the rot in our culture may indeed be contributing, if not to the aspiration for freedom elsewhere, the undoing of it here. But let's talk a little bit about kind of the thinking at the moment of the libertarian cohort on national security. And where are we in terms of things like what I would describe as hollowing out of the military in the furtherance of sequestration and issues like, you know, the Patriot Act and NSA? Do we have really now a dramatic break between libertarians and other conservatives on national security issues?
I wonder about that. I mean, libertarians tend to be a pretty strenuously anti-interventionist. They worry about kind of the permanent warfare state. You hear words like that. I, in that cohort, am, you know, they think that I'm way too interventionist.
You are.
In general, because I've supported past.
Well, talking with me probably will ruin your credentials further, but thank you for
sure.
Doing it.
No, but we're also in an interesting moment where you have guys like Rand Paul who is trying to sell or kind of forge a new kind of workable, libertarian-influenced foreign policy, and he's flying it under the banner of Ronald Reagan. He's going to the Heritage Foundation and getting respectful hearings and going to the Reagan Library. He recognizes in ways that his father never really did that, yes, right now, the problems with Islam is a direct national threat and will be for our lifetimes,
yeah,
the
I'm
kind
afraid.
Of civil war happening there, the wars of modernity and things like that. And we have to adopt a strategy to confront that. But he's also starting to have that conversation. I think you're seeing a lot of conservatives start to wonder now about the wisdom of kind of defaulting towards interventionism, excusing the excesses of, you know, or just the darknesses of the surveillance state a little bit now. So I think both sides are a little bit in flux and coming towards each other in ways that I think is actually kind of useful, not necessarily that there will be some answer arrived at, but I think a fair reading of post 9/11 foreign policy says we kind of went a little bit far in certain directions. We had unrealistic ideas about what the Iraq war would produce in terms of generating freedom. And I think the ultimate question is, and there's no real answer, and certainly you and I probably are not going to agree on this, but the ability of America as the kind of hegemonic power, the unipower of the world, to influence and kind of control and shape world events. I think the libertarian tendency will say more that, you know, we can't. We can try all we want, but the world just sort of acts in ways that are beyond our control. And that was also true, by the way, in the collapse of communism, which we all forget now because it looks clean in retrospect. But world leaders were kind of powerless to deal with this onrushing of freedom, you know, and in ways that it's pretty interesting to go back and look at.
This is a subject for a much longer conversation, Matt Welch. I hope we can do it soon because I think you're right. There are certainly dynamics at work both among conservative foreign policy and national security folks and libertarians, and it would be desirable to find some common ground if we could, and perhaps we can begin to forge it here. Thank you so much for joining me. It's great to talk with you. We look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.